I don't think there's anything major I would tell you that I wouldn't tell posterity.
Okay, great. Well, thanks. Let me just say for the record, we're at the FCIC and talking to Robert Kuttner. And we may be joined by a colleague or two as we go on here.
Sure.
But let me ask you, you know, the commission's charged with trying to figure out the causes of this financial crisis.
Right.
So let me ask you kind of the obvious question up front. What do you see as the main causes of this crisis we went through and are still going through?
Well, the ideology and the practice of extreme laissez-faire as applied to the financial sector, which had several dimensions to it. One was the corruption of laws and regulatory processes that were on the books. They were either not enforced or there was all kinds of political pressure brought to bear to undermine their enforcement. Secondly, there was the explicit statutory deregulation. Thirdly, there was a willful failure to keep up with innovation in financial markets, and all innovations were blessed as ipso facto beneficial when some of them proved to be fraudulent or otherwise unwise and harmful. There were entire sectors like credit rating agencies where there was a wholesale regulatory default. There was the delegation of regulatory functions to industry self-regulatory bodies that had no interest in strong regulation. And so the way this all played out was to have more and more reliance on highly speculative instruments, often based on short-term debt financing or other short-term capital market financing, not backed by real at-risk capital. And so when the bubble burst, the damage was just incalculable, and we're still paying the price. Now, that's one dimension of it. Another dimension of it, I think, has to do with the fact that under both Democratic and Republican administrations, treasuries and the central bank, the Fed, tend to be much too close to the financial institutions and have as their premise serving the interest of and rescuing the bad decisions of financial institutions rather than paying attention to the broader well-being of the economy. So that's it in a nutshell.
Right. Now, leaving aside the regulatory questions, some folks have pointed the finger at the Federal Reserve keeping rates low for a sustained period. And I'm curious how you see that.
Yeah, it's a complete red herring because it leaves out half the story. During the post-World War II boom, when the Fed was not a law unto itself, but it was a politically accountable institution, the Fed kept interest rates very low in order to finance the war debt. That was an entente that lasted from 1941 to 1951. You want real interest rates to be low, but if you're going to have low real interest rates, you need to combine it with vigilant prudential regulation. The mischief was in having low interest rates without the regulation, and that's the part that the people who were purveyors of that story never include. Because if you have very low interest rates and opportunities for scams and opportunities for speculative use of the cheap credit, that's what gets you into trouble. But if you have well-regulated cheap credit, that's exactly what you want.
Right. So by extension, I assume the other thing that kind of liquidity folks have pointed to is all the money sloshing around the globe from China and elsewhere. And I assume that's also a red herring.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, the whether that liquidity was used in a speculative way or a constructive way was entirely a function of regulatory policy. If you if you basically have no meaningful regulation, then that money is free to go to its most speculative uses.
Right.
So it's an alibi for the failure of regulation to do its job.
Right. So your criticisms of Greenspan, say, are on the regulatory side and not...
Yeah, totally. And I think the other point is that you had the Fed conflate three very distinct responsibilities, which should have been and should be going forward kept separate. One is its role as monetary authority. One as, actually four, three and a half, depending on how you count. So you have the Fed as setter of monetary policy. That's its default role, its year-in, year-out role. Then you have the Fed also playing a regulatory role. You have the Fed playing a lender of last resort role. And you have the Fed as a bailout institution. Those are conceptually distinct roles. But what happened was the Fed used monetary policy beginning in 1990 to bail out failures of previous regulatory authority power. And you had several cycles of this. You had this with the third world debt. You had it in the early 90s. You had it with the Asian crisis with long-term capital management. Secondly, you had the Fed in the most recent crisis using very, very cheap money to overcome or to camouflage the failure of the most recent round of regulatory policy. And you had individual decisions to bail out particular institutions with very little public accountability being conflated with its general role as lender of last resort in a crisis. And if you go back and read the statute, that's not supposed to empower the Fed to pick winners and losers. And in fact, the statute says that it's supposed to, this goes back to Walter Badgett's conception of the central bank as the lender of last resort. It's supposed to make very easy credit available based on collateral. It's not supposed to bail out bankrupt institutions like Citigroup.
Right. If I could just pause one second, I was just going to try to conference in a colleague.
Sure.
Okay. We're just talking about Greenspan's failings. Bob, you were saying?
Well, just that the the blame of cheap money is misstated in that the mischief was the combination of cheap money with regulatory default.
Right.
Cheap money combined with prudent regulation is a good thing for the economy. It's cheap money when cheap money is used to camouflage or bail out past regulatory failures and is not combined with prudential regulation, that then it becomes an instrument of speculation.
I think I could guess that, you know, the deregulation of the Reagan era and also of the, Clinton era would, be what you see as the groundwork for...
Well, it's both the, yes, but it's both the deregulation and the de-enforcement, mm-hmm. and then the out-and-out corruption. I mean, it's three somewhat distinct things. So that, you know, Glass-Steagall was undermined in practice for a decade, long before it was finally officially repealed. And Arthur Levitt, who was, so-so as a regulatory hawk, in my view, was threatened with loss of his appropriations if he issued certain rules. And to me, that's an example of political corruption of regulation. And then Greenspan explicitly refused to issue regs to enforce the 1994 home equity owner, HOEPA, Home Equity Ownership
Right.
Protection Act, which if it had been enforced would have probably prevented subprime. So you have to unpack, disaggregate what we mean by regulatory failure. And as I said before, I think it's three distinct things that all fed on each other. It was statutory deregulation and administrative failure to enforce and then corruption.
Right. And what do you think could have been done differently once once things started going south, you know, in terms of Bernanke's response to the crisis, Bear Stearns, Lehman, other sort of turning points over the last few years?
Well, it depends on which turning point you're talking about. I mean, once...
Well, let's say 2007, when the first, you know, the Bear hedge funds go down and, you know, trouble in some of the European banks, and clearly something is very much amiss.
Well, I think at that point it's too late to prevent it because it's baked into the cake. I think, you know, you can second guess whether there were double standards applied to different institutions that were rescued or were not rescued. I mean, that hellish week in September of 08, I mean, you had four different regulatory strategies for four different institutions. So I think it's a little bit hard to second guess the crisis response where they, in the first phase, where they just pour on liquidity, we and the Europeans, in order to keep the whole financial system from seizing up. I think the strategic mistake they made was to, and of course, given the Bush administration, this just wasn't going to happen, but it might have happened once Obama became president. The mistake they made was to de-link reform and restructuring of the industry from bailing out the industry, because in the fall and winter of 08, 09, the industry was in the role of supplicant, and they did not use that leverage to remake the whole structure of the industry so that the whole business model of the industry would change from one where every bank really wanted to be a hedge fund to one where investment banks go back to their traditional business of taking risks but not passing those risks onto the whole system, and commercial banks go back to their traditional business of supplying credit and assessing risks of ordinary business lenders. And I think even in the most recent legislation, there was a failure to revisit the entire business model that has become normal in financial institutions. So I guess my second guessing would start in the fall of 08.
Gotcha.
And because up until then, you did have to throw liquidity at the problem. You could have done some things differently, but I think TARP was badly written, and they could have waited a few more weeks to put a lot more transparency into it, more safeguards. The oversight panel, which has been the one source of some sunlight, was almost in there by accident. And in fact, it was headed by a much tougher person than they bargained for. I mean, the guy who was originally supposed to be the head of it was Neiman, who was much more of a pro-Wall Street guy, and they realized that, and they insisted on Warren. I think TARP was badly designed, and then I think it was misused both by the old regime of Paulson, Bernanke, and Geithner, and by the new regime of Geithner, Summers, and Bernanke. I mean, it's two of the three same people. And then I think the other second guessing I would do was whether it was smart to prop up institutions that were effectively insolvent rather than do resolutions the way the FDIC does resolutions. Because we're living with the aftermath of that. We have weakened financial institutions that are disguising the degree of their weakness, doing everything they can to rebuild balance sheets, rather than having had a true reckoning in 08 and 09 before we pumped all this money into it. And yeah, the government's getting a lot of its money back, but the price that is being paid by the system is that you have this paradox of very cheap capital and very scarce credit, or very scarce very cheap credit and scarce capital. I mean, the banks compensate for their risk aversion by raising lending standards to the point where perfectly good borrowers have a very difficult time getting credit, so that the Fed can lower rates all at once. That mainly helps Wall Street, doesn't help the rest of the economy. And I think the other thing I would criticize is, to this day, and I hope you guys shed some light on this, is the complete lack of transparency in all of these deals, most of which were done through the New York Fed. And to this day, the New York Fed is resisting a real postmortem, because they will be embarrassed by what they did if the details come more fully to light. I mean, a lot of this stuff was surfaced by AIG, because AIG got tired of being the scapegoat. But, there are so many unanswered questions that the oversight panel is trying to get answers to for 2 years, or a year and a half. They don't have subpoena power, as to exactly, you know, what happened with some of these deals that the New York Fed was at the center of.
Gotcha. Bob, we're also joined by my colleague, Tom Stanton.
Hey, Bob.
Oh, another old friend. Boy,
yes.
you got the cream of the crop here.
Yeah. Or Tom.
Well, basically, I came in and you were talking about sort of how we handled the crisis. I may have missed your discussion of the elements leading up to the crisis and lessons to be learned from that.
Yeah, that was my opening.
Okay, you don't need to go over. We've recorded it. I'll listen.
Right.
I won't bother you to repeat again.
Okay.
Bob, one dimension that I wanted to ask you about was we focused on that it wasn't simply low interest rates that was one of the preconditions or preparatory stages for the crisis, but I wanted to ask you also about your thoughts about the consequences of Greenspan raising interest rates starting in, I believe, May of 2004.
Well, I mean, I think this is what the Fed does. If you don't have financial institutions so heavily dependent on very short-term money and don't have them so highly leveraged, you know, 30 to 1 and more, rather than traditional 6, 8, 10 to 1, then it's not that big a deal when the Fed countercyclically raises interest rates. So again, I'd have to go back and look at that, but you know, I'm a cheap money guy. I think it's good for the economy if you have relatively low interest rates, but then the offset, the ballast that you have to have is good regulation.
Bob, where do you see the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie, fitting into this, if at all?
Can I follow up on the interest rate question?
Oh, sure. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
It's all right. It's one of the problems of being on the phone. If the firms would have been more prudentially regulated and we'd have raised rates from 1% to 5.25%, would that have how would that, you know, protected us from problems like so many homeowners having variable rate mortgages, or there being a very strong quantitative credit expansion in the private sector despite the higher short-term rates?
Well, but a quantitative expansion in the private sector is a function of what the regulatory rules are. I mean, that's the whole thing. Let me take the two questions in tandem. You know, he probably raised interest rates too fast and too high, but I think that was a secondary or a tertiary problem. It was the interaction of the interest rate environment with the lack of prudential rules. So there's nothing wrong with variable rates, although I certainly wouldn't use them in my own life. If they're not subprime, if normal lending standards are applied, I mean, people can pick and choose whether they want fixed rates or variable rates, but if they're not being misled by the lender, and the lender is not playing games with the investment bank and the credit rating agency. They're a perfectly sound variant form of credit. So it wasn't variable rates that got into trouble. It was subprime and Alt A and all the other razzle dazzle.
I don't mean to sound make the question sound hostile at all, but I have to ask them in that way so that your responses on the record are addressing those questions.
Sure. Be as hostile as you want.
Okay, sorry, Tom. Go ahead.
It wasn't me. It was Matt.
Well, I was asking Bob where he sees the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie, fitting into all this.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, the GSEs are the favorite scapegoat of people who don't want to look at the deeper sources of the problem. And it's a very complicated story because the GSEs got partly corrupted. But the timing is crucial. So let's go all the way back. I don't like the term GSEs. So the Federal National Mortgage Association gets set up as a public institution to create a very rudimentary secondary mortgage market where there's no slicing and dicing, there's no turning of this stuff into derivative securities. It's simply the original FNMA as a part of the U.S. government using the Treasury borrowing rate to sell its own securities and purchase mortgages, period, end of story. And that worked like a Swiss watch until 1968-69 when, for purely budgetary reasons, they decided to privatize it to get it off of the consolidated budget as part of the Budget Reform Act of 68. So then you fast forward to around 1980, when Louis Ranieri invents mortgage-backed securities, and after a while Fannie and then Freddie start losing market share and they start behaving more like an ordinary profit-making institution instead of like a quasi-public institution that's still implicitly backed by the U.S. Treasury. However, even with the fact that Fannie and Freddie consumes too much market share, maybe, or pays itself too much money and starts behaving too much like a proprietary institution that just happens to have a line of credit with the Treasury, it's not until 07 that when two things happen. Bush is pushing the ownership society idea, and there's political pressure on Fannie and Freddie to buy up a lot of junk. And secondly, Wall Street is trying to unload a lot of junk, which they suddenly realize it's going south. And so Fannie becomes a kind of a toxic waste dump for securities that the wise guys on Wall Street suddenly appreciate are going to go very, very, very bad. So I think Fannie and Freddie, going back to 69 and then 80 and then 2007, is a case of an institution that had a public mission being subverted and misused. And there are lots of people's fingerprints on it. I mean, there are Democrat fingerprints on it. There are Bush administration fingerprints on it. But to draw the inference that it's a bad idea to have a public institution at the center of the nation's secondary mortgage market, or to have a public institution setting standards for the nation's secondary mortgage market, that's exactly the wrong inference.
Right. Tom?
No, I'm listening because I'm trying to digest it, and the question then would become the sources of that change by the GSEs.
Well, you have to take it stage by stage, and there are people who are better experts on this than I, who I would recommend you talk to. I mean, Barry Zegas is certainly one. Another would be Ellen Seidman, who've watched the thing more close up from a basically pro-consumer viewpoint. Do you know them?
Yeah, actually, yes.
Okay, so I'm trying to remember the exact time period, but in the Clinton era, you know, you can sort of track it by reading Wall Street Journal editorials. The private competitors of Fannie and Freddie, particularly Fannie, are very unhappy because Fannie is starting to behave like it's just another private corporation, which just happens to have a pipeline to the federal government and the implicit guarantee of the federal government, and it's consuming market share. Now, in fact, it's also undercutting them. I mean, it's offering, if you interview bankers, Fannie is offering them a better deal because its costs are lower than private investment banking firms are. So they're furious with some justification. And then, unfortunately, Fannie also becomes a place for Democratic politicians to get rich. And so that infuriates Republicans and the private competitors of Fannie even more. So by the late 90s, you have a kind of a storyline, which is substantially true, that Fannie is going beyond its ostensible public mission and competing unfairly with the private sector and making a lot of Democratic politicians who got cushy jobs very rich. But what Fannie is not doing, which has become part of the latter-day indictment against Fannie, is it's not enabling the subprime market. Fannie is trying to hold the line on standards, and it's the guys in the private investment banks and commercial banks that are creating the subprime monster. So that distinction, not to exonerate or exculpate Fannie, but those two strands of the story need to be kept very separate.
Do you attach any significance to the question of leverage of Fannie and Freddie?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole damn thing was too highly leveraged with not enough in the way of regulatory standards. One other thing, by the way, the other red herring that you encounter over and over and over again is the story that we made a mistake by trying to help low-income people become home buyers. I mean, there's a way of doing that properly, and there's a way of doing it corruptly. And until 2003, 2004, 2005, you did not have higher default rates because you didn't lower standards, and you combined it with counseling, and it was done virtuously, and then it was done corruptly.
I don't understand how the culture of the two institutions would change so profoundly so quickly.
Well, it changes gradually because now we're talking here late 80s, early 90s. I mean, I actually think it was a gradual change. Who was asking the question?
This is Tom. I thought it was more the mid-2000s forward that suddenly things changed, and I was trying to understand that inflection point.
Well, there's two different inflection points. One is Frank Raines decides to get rich. So there's that era.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Johnson decides to get rich. Jim Johnson looks at, you know, the guys on Wall Street and says, hey, I can do this too. So that's one inflection point. And I think that was lousy. I think that was the perversion of an institution that still had something of a public mission. But it didn't crash the economy the way the second inflection point did. The second inflection point is pressure on Fannie from the Bush White House, in line with the Conservative Opportunity Society, and in league with Wall Street's need to unload this stuff to buy a lot of real craft. And that doesn't really start until, I'd have to go back and check, but maybe 07, maybe 06,
mm-hmm. Okay.
But maybe 05. I mean, Fannie lowers its own standards in terms of what kind of paper it will buy, which the Wall Street guys love because they get to unload it. And then all the toxic junk ends up on Fannie's books and less of it on their books.
Got it. Thanks. And what about the, you talked about the consumer side of this. I mean, the borrowers seem to be the ones that are always left out. How do we demonstrate, if you had a mortgage broker out there and a borrower with a stated income loan, how do we demonstrate who was at fault when somebody's income was unbelievably overstated in the mortgage?
Well, I assume that if you actually go out and do this as a journalist and you talk to these people, that most of these borrowers are fairly unsophisticated. There was a certain fraction of them, 15-20%, something like that, who were fairly sophisticated borrowers, who knew exactly what the game was. But there was a very large percentage of them who were elderly, whose houses were paid off, who were talked into taking out subprime loans as a way of pulling equity out of the house. There were, you know, people who were immigrants who were just trying to get a foot in the door of the American dream. And so in that case, where the mortgage banker or the mortgage broker says, just sign here and, you know, you can inflate your income. It's done all the time. Don't worry about it. It's okay. He's supposedly the expert. It sounds a little bit too good to be true, but I mean, so I would put most of the blame on the mortgage brokers, who should know better. And the only reason they don't know better is because there's a whole system in place where somebody buys the paper and it gets blessed as you know, a triple A investment and gets turned into a bond that some other sucker buys. So I think I think it's perverse to put most of the blame on the borrowers. And you know, the tragedy here is that responsible lenders, like outfits like Shore Bank, are there trying to uphold standards, and they're competing with the local Sharpies who are lowering standards. And now Shore Bank is almost bankrupt itself because it's devoted so much effort to cleaning up somebody else's mess.
Does that mean, did they change their standards, or what was
going on? No, they're just, what happens is, a loan that was a perfectly good loan when Shore Bank made it in 2004 is now underwater because property values have fallen by 40%.
Ah, okay, the consequences, yeah.
Yeah. So there's all these spillover consequences to innocent bystanders.
One of my the quotes that most fascinates me is one from Alan Greenspan that he gave to the House Government Oversight Committee, which was, and I'm paraphrasing what was elegant in his presentation, that what surprised him most was the failure of so many private firms, especially banks, to represent their own best interests and those of their owners. Do you have a sense what was going on there? I mean, that's sort of a sweeping concern then on, everybody understands how the regulators didn't stand up to the task, but this is sort of a sweeping statement about the private sector.
Well, there was a lot of easy short-term gain to be had. And I think in a perverse kind of way, they were representing the short-term interests of their executives and their shareholders, who were doing very well until it all collapsed, and they weren't being mindful of the systemic risk. And, you know, there's a phrase in the hedge fund industry that you may have come across, IBG, YBG. You heard that one?
No.
Stands for I'll be gone, you'll be gone. And that was the ethic on Wall Street in 2006. So are they representing the interests of their owners? Well, if a hedge fund who's playing these games is returning 25%, the owner's pretty happy. And if a lot of the biggest shareholders or senior executives who are getting huge bonuses, they're pretty happy. And until the whole thing came crashing down, everybody was happy. So that's why the fault is more Greenspan's than it is the executives of these institutions who behaved exactly the way you would expect them to do. I mean, the whole idea of a banker as a long-term steward of anything is long gone and will not be rebuilt until you rebuild prudential regulation, which in turn will change norms. But when you take away the regulation, these guys are going to do what they do. They're going to make as much money as they can and pawn as much of the risk off on somebody else.
That's nice. I'll remember that, IBG, YBG.
Yeah. Let me just say,
yeah.
I think the single most important thing you guys can do is shed some light on exactly what the New York Fed was doing in all of these deals, these bailout deals from about October of 08 through maybe the summer of 09. Because bits and pieces have come out in the Journal and the Times in some of the expose books, but and in some of the stuff that AIG has dumped. But the dots haven't been connected in a coherent way.
Okay.
And it is the last thing in the world that Tim Geithner wants to have come out.
Bob, is there something in particular that you got suspicions about that you hadn't seen investigated thoroughly?
Well, I mean, on what basis did they decide to put $45 billion of taxpayer money into Citigroup when everybody knew that Citigroup was insolvent? What kind of a process did they go through? You know, there's still a lot of the AIG story, the following of the money, that hasn't been fully accounted for. The $203 or $206 billion of Citigroup assets that they guaranteed in the third wave of this, what were those? Were they valued at book value or market value? How was this portfolio chosen? I mean, there was a period when they were just inventing stuff on the fly, throwing money at these institutions, and there hasn't really been a reckoning. And there's a kind of a counterfactual of how else they might have done it, which, you know, people like Stiglitz and Krugman and Sheila Bair and I and Damon Silvers and Elizabeth Warren have argued would have been the better policy.
What about Fannie and Freddie in that regard?
Well, again, I think once Fannie and Freddie became a kind of a toxic waste dump, the only question is how you unwind that over time. I mean, the standards should never have been lowered in the Bush era. They should not have, I don't think they ever should have been privatized if you want to go all the way back. So now the view is, well, let's just wind it down and put them out of business entirely. I mean, I would rather see, and I'm a wild outlier on this, but I would rather see them reconstituted as a fully public body to be the standard setter and the anchor of the secondary mortgage market. And I would want a much smaller role for with much higher standards and more skin in the game of securitization done by investment banks. I mean, the story is you need the securitization for liquidity. You have far much more securitization than you need. You have securitization mainly because it was a very handy way of making a lot of short-term money and getting somebody else to bear the risk. And, of course, ultimately the whole system bears the risk. And you need more of a plain vanilla financial system going forward. It's not just the too big to fail, it's the too big to understand and hence too big to regulate system that has metastasized from a simpler, more rudimentary system without proportional benefits that are anywhere near consonant with the increased risk. I mean, most of this stuff was invented not because the real economy needed it, but because it was a way for middlemen to get very rich.
So you're a follower of Paul Volcker that the last useful innovation in the financial system was the ATM?
Yeah, and a guy who you ought to talk to is a guy named Yaga Reddy, who was the recently retired governor of the Bank of India. And in 2006, there was tremendous pressure brought to bear on Reddy to allow Indian banks to engage in the same kind of stuff that American and British banks were engaging in. And Reddy used reserve requirements to prohibit it. He said to me, we're a poor developing country. We just don't understand all these exotic instruments, so we leave them to the advanced countries like you. And as a consequence, India did not even suffer a hiccup because the banks in India were not permitted to go in for this stuff. So he's an expert, along with Volcker, on how you use reserve requirements and other forms of regulation to limit securitization to its economically beneficial and necessary forms.
Good. Well, Bob, you've been very kind with your time, especially.
Sure. No, I'm just delighted you guys are there.
Well, we're trying.
I have subpoena envy.
Well, be careful. We may call you.
All right.
No, thank you very much,
just
Bob.
Don't call me in August.
All right. All right. Thank you, Bob.
Hey, thanks. Take care.
Yeah, bye.
Thank you.